Welcome to an episode of Weekly Weights. We lift weights and we are mates. On the weekend we go on dates. Weekly Weights, Jim and Footy.
Weekly Weights with Alex and Will.
Welcome to episode 19 of Weekly Weights. We're here with a very special guest, Nathan Baxter.
Nathan has Australia's biggest ever bench press, and for about 3 or 4 years he held the total record. This is back in the days before raw lifting existed, or as he put it, when raw lifting was just what they called training. What else happened? Yeah. He won the first ever raw Nats. Is that true? Yeah, won the first ever raw Nationals, and so you know he's a well-known figure in Australian powerlifting. Nathan, what have we missed about you?
I've 5 times been voted the sexiest man in the IPF.
Biggest liar in the IPF.
I think with Amir Fazeli, I was the first person to go to the Arnold Classic in the US.
Yeah, cool.
For their raw meat.
Other sexiest man in the IPF, Amir.
Amir. Yeah, let's not go there. Mostly I'm just disappointed that you've waited till episode 19 to get me on, so...
Well, we wanted to build up a following to justify it. We thought if we came to you for episode 1, you'd say, you know, come back when you've had 100,000 listens.
Yeah, that's a fair call. I like that. That pleases my ego.
Stroke the ego.
So what we're going to do today is talk a little bit to Nathan about... Sorry, I've just had a French bulldog attack me. We're going to talk to Nathan a little bit about his philosophy around lifting, the history of powerlifting in Australia, and then also get into a little bit of bench press specific technique. So when you held the national record, there was no such thing as raw lifting in Australia. So the first thing I want to sort of do is get from you an idea of how powerlifting in Australia and globally has changed during your involvement.
That's a really interesting question, because you start going, well, how far back do I go?
Well, when did you start powerlifting?
So even that's an odd question. My first competition was 2007.
What was your total?
I don't know. It was raw. It was like 650 or something.
That's my total.
Yeah, it's not bad. Okay, go on.
I did that on a busted hip and had no idea what I was doing, because it was pre-internet, really. There was a little bit of information around, but not much. And I used to train by myself in Karratha up in the Pilbara.
Yeah.
And I decided when I hit certain numbers in the gym, then I should probably go and do a meet somewhere. But I wanted to make sure they were good enough to justify the expense of driving for 16 hours, the accommodation, all the fuel costs or whatever. So I did the 2007 WA state titles, and I won that.
Was that a 650 total with a 200 kilo bench?
No, that was a 160 bench, I think it was.
Yeah. What weight class was this?
Oh, super heavyweight. I've never not been a super.
Forever super.
Forever super. Okay. Yeah.
I think I was probably super heavyweight in high school.
Me too.
I was Brandon Carr before Brandon Carr existed.
Okay.
And now there's a name that most people won't recognize either. But if you've got any old people listening, hopefully they remember Brandon Carr.
So you're a 650 total. You were training in the Pilbara, you said.
Yeah,
you've driven 16 hours.
Fell over in the warm-up with 300 kilos on my back. Probably shouldn't have competed that day. Or probably shouldn't have competed for the next few years, knowing what I now know. I now know that I need hip surgery. I need a hip replacement because of that. But I ended up squatting and deadlifting that day. I just wanted to do just a rough total so I could qualify for nationals that year. I think it was around 650 or 700. I'm really bad with the numbers that I've done.
Right. So that was your first involvement in powerlifting. What were the...
Yeah.
I mean, there's not even state titles anymore within Powerlifting Australia. So I guess that's one change. But what was it like competing then? So raw lifting didn't really exist, for one.
Yeah, raw wasn't a thing. And it's pretty funny the way I got involved with PA... was just because Robert Wilkes was the first person to answer his phone. Now, I'd been following powerlifting since the 90s, and so I knew names like Adam Coe, Dino Toshi, like all the stars of Kappa. They used to be in Iron Man magazine, and I used to get Powerlifting USA every now and then as well from the newsagent. And so when I went online to find out who to compete with, I saw Adam's name and kept on trying to call him. And Adam was a great lifter, probably the second best lifter in the world at one stage behind Ed Cohen.
Who?
And
there's a name everyone knows.
Yeah.
You don't mention. Are we allowed to mention his name now?
Yeah, like,
you might get a ban.
On this podcast, you can say whatever you want, and if we don't like it, then we just run it by the thought police and you know blur it out or record a really dodgy voiceover of what you meant to say. Yeah.
Your face when Will said who's that was.
So I kept on trying to call Adam to do a competition with Capo.
Yeah.
And I found out afterwards that he used to change his mobile phone number like most people change their underwear.
Right.
I then called the guy who was heading up WA, Alan Scarini, who's still involved with PA here in Perth. And his email address kept on changing because he works for a government department. So I never got through to him. And then I called Robert's number and he called me back and we had the first of many really interesting conversations.
Yeah.
About competing, and he set up a comp in Perth for us. It was me and one other person, so we had more spotters than competitors.
So did that mean you had to? You're in the same group, but did you guys have to have like 4 minute spacing between attempts, just because otherwise you were basically following yourself, or was it like a 10 minute meet?
Oh no, we went fast. We went really fast that day, and we just added time into. To make it kind of reasonable. So it was really a training session in someone's gym with people watching.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, that's what competitions looked like, really all over the place. I have no idea what the question was originally.
Well, the question was, how has powerlifting in Australia and globally changed during your involvement? So it sounded, at that stage, at the very least, very amateurish. What was nationals like that year?
Nationals that year was in Brisbane. It was in the mall in Brisbane. Really professionally run competition. Probably one of the best ever that I can remember going to. Massive crowd. They had a big stand out in the middle of the mall opposite the, I think it's like the Treasury Casino or something. But I don't know. There was heaps of people there. It was heaps of fun and
massive powerlifting crowd or massive crowd.
Both. Both.
Yeah, that's cool.
So it was, and so those competitions back then were really cool for getting people in. So it was almost like the expos before we had expos.
Yeah.
But local comps were really just to try and get people through the books, essentially, because powerlifting was so fringe and lifting weights was still kind of weird and it was done by weird people. So probably over the years, the amount of weird people in the world has multiplied due to the internet. So it's just a great way for – originally, the internet was just a really cool way for people to share porn.
Yeah.
Now it's for sharing porn, cat videos, and powerlifting.
Yeah, sometimes all at once.
I want to see that video.
So Nathan, when did you get involved in Powerlifting Australia as an official?
Oh, as an official, almost straight away, okay. Because we had almost no officials here in Perth. So in order to, I think I was I did my national level referee ticket in 2008. I flew over to Melbourne. I did the Melbourne Open or something.
Yep.
I think that was the first time I broke the bench record. It was like March or April 2008 or something like that. And so I did my referee's ticket so that way we could start running more competitions in Perth, take the pressure off the old guys and get things through like that.
So you've said two things that I thought were really interesting that I want to follow up. The first was that sort of local competitions were a way of getting people through the books. So the emphasis sounds like it was very much on national and international competition if you're a competitor, and then local comps were just sort of something they did to tick the box. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I guess I'm really specifically talking about Western Australia and more particularly Perth. When powerlifting was up and running sort of through the 80s and 90s, the WA lifting community was the strongest. It was, when powerlifting was at its peak, it was in its peak in WA. Because of a few administrative changes, we'll call them, WA powerlifting almost died. And it was because of the work of a few guys keeping competitions going that there was anything for me to walk into when I got here. So me and Paul McManus and Alan Scarini just tried to run as many competitions as possible, working on the theory that if we ran a lot and just tried to get people in all the time, some of those people would stay and would have a big community. And it took a long time to get like competitions with multiple flights or multiple sessions. But it was just really a numbers game, trying to get people going. But for me, I wanted to compete against the best. And my focus was always going to nationals or international.
Right. I want to just ask, so you say when powerlifting was at its biggest, it was at its strongest in Western Australia. When was powerlifting at its biggest in Australia, and what were the changes that you're referring to?
Well, yeah, I would, before CAPO and Powerlifting Australia existed, back when it was one federation, you know, we had the Women's World Championships in Adelaide, the Men's World Championships here in Perth. So I think it was 1987 or 88, we had, here in Perth, we had Ed Cohen, Gene Bell, David, I think David Ricks was out for that one, Jano Virtanen, like all these Hall of Fame guys all lifting here in Perth. It was massive, massive competitions.
That's cool.
There was a number of Australian world champions, especially in women's, in the, I think that was 86 World Championships in Adelaide. The second biggest total in the world in 1988, at 110 kilos, was Adam Coe from Melbourne. The only person that did a total bigger than him was Ed Cohen. And I'm pretty sure that was a world record total that he set here in Perth. Back when they used 50-kilo Evanco plates, two of which I have in my garage now.
Very cool.
Okay, the next thing that I wanted to follow up with you was you were talking about reading Powerlifting USA magazine. And it's funny because, like, if I go on Elite FTS and read the articles of all the old-timers, they're always talking about reading, yeah, PLUSA mags and powerlifting magazines and stuff and getting routines from that. And it's a bit like old-school bodybuilding where you learn people's routines from it. Whereas now I think information is disseminated through the internet. So I guess I want to know from you, like, when did that change? And also, what was different about learning about powerlifting back then?
Well, yeah, like I'm talking about through the 90s, getting powerlifting magazine, Powerlifting USA from the news agency. And so if I was getting the US January edition, like January 1991, I was probably getting that in September, October here in Australia. So I was literally finding out what happened a year ago at a competition and trying to work out who was good, who wasn't, who I should follow. A lot of it was more about meet results and stories rather than programming.
Yep.
And like, literally there was no internet, in 1991. So information was passed on, person to person or through magazines like that. I remember going to uni for the first time in, was it 1995? There was 24 computers for the whole university and they're all in one room.
Yeah, cool.
So now we get the, you know, we get this instant sharing of information about how to do anything, and information spreads rapidly, which I think is a great thing for, especially for ease of entry into lifting. Is all I have to do is get on Instagram now and search one hashtag, and I've got 24 different variations of a squat I can try.
All you have to do is go to iTunes and search Weekly Weights and learn some stuff.
Yeah, you can learn anything on Weekly Weights.
Because what's that called? Weekly Weights.
Yeah, Weekly Weights. Look it up. It's a good podcast. Leave a review if you want. Like, subscribe. They sometimes read things out on air if you review them. So you've given us this really interesting landscape of powerlifting in Australia back in the late Cretaceous period. Now I want to know what's changed between then and now and what's been good and bad about that.
Listen, I don't want to become one of those old guys that say all the changes have been bad and everything back in my day was good. Most of what we did sort of through the 90s and 2000s, it took a really long time to realize that we were wrong. So you had to do something for a few months and then go do a comp and go, Oh, holy shit, that was the dumbest thing I could imagine doing, because your total would suffer.
Mm.
Whereas now, with the feedback, and if we look at it from a purely motor learning point of view, the more the closer the feedback is to the event, the better you get at doing something. So the fact that we can live feed something and have 20 people monitoring a squat or a bench press as it happens and giving critical feedback right then and there, I think can only benefit the sport. I think all the arguments of why it was better before kind of come down to I grew up eating biscuits and kids now eat cookies.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's a who cares. I think the technological advances have been nothing but helpful. I think if you look at the development of both CrossFit and raw powerlifting, which really raw powerlifting is just a branch of CrossFit, right?
I can't wait till we compete for reps, honestly. Yeah, go on.
It all took off with the advent of Instagram. And people complain about the Instagram lifters and they're doing it for the gram, they're just doing it for likes. I'm like, oh, who gives a shit? It's people lifting weights.
Yeah, it's actually grown the sport so much. A lot of it's bad, but a lot of it's really good.
Yeah, you know, like you're always going to get bad growth but I think the majority of the growth is good. There's this really coloured view of history that all the growth previously was good growth, which is rubbish.
Mm.
You know, some of the old growth produced Westside.
That's like probably the fifth time we've bashed Westside in this podcast.
Yeah, we barely have to bash Westside. We just get people on, don't even bring it up, and you just know, you know, somebody's going to make a Westside reference every podcast.
It bashes itself.
It's an easy joke to make, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
The growth of powerlifting, we got to the point where growing powerlifting meant that we had triple ply grid stitched reinforced bench shirts, which were just the weirdest thing to look at. Like, people have problems with bench shirts now. The single ply, like a scoop neck super katana, they've got nothing on an open back denim bench shirt.
I want to clip that little bit and sort of pitch it as like a segment about powerlifting fashion, because the way you just described that made it sound like the problems with the look. Like, who would wear a scoop neck?
Like, yeah. That was so last year.
Yeah, well, it was so late 90s.
Get yourself some animal prints, bring it back, make it look pretty.
So when we were setting up for this podcast, you used a Bruce Lee quote to describe what you thought about lifting. So can you tell
it makes me sound really wise.
Can you tell everyone what that quote is and then how you relate it to lifting?
Yeah, so it's a really, I'll butcher the quote because I'll claim it as mine eventually.
Yeah.
And there's a really easy system for doing that. Like, if I mention something once, like I said, this one time Alex told me about squatting. If I say it a few times and I go, well, this guy once told me that this is how you squat. And if I say it often enough, I go, as I always say, this is how you do a squat. So that's how you steal a quote.
Right.
So
involves us imagining you doing Kung Fu.
It's not that hard to imagine, really.
Well, Kung Fu Panda was a movie.
I was going to say, just think about Jack Black and you'll get this. So it was before I studied the art, a punch was just like a punch and a kick was just like a kick. When I studied the art, a punch was so much more than a punch and a kick was so much more than a kick. But now I understand the art. A punch is just like a punch and a kick is just like a kick. If you take anybody off the street and go, what's a bench press? And they go, it's just down and up. If I get the average powerlifter or 98% of powerlifters, they will give you a 7.5-hour dissertation on what's going on in the bench press.
And everyone except for Will, because Will doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's just down and up, man.
And then if you get to – once you get to a certain level, like I remember I spoke to Freddie Smolter, who's possibly definitely one of the greatest benchers of all time from Finland. I go, Freddie, what's benching? He goes, it's just speed and volume. That's it. It's just down and up. You take away, you put it on your chest, you press it back up. And so we're constantly trying to refine these models to get to that really simple essential element of what a lift is. I know I spoke to JP Couchy about what the essential element of a deadlift and squat is, and we both believe the same thing, that really a squat, whether it's a barbell squat or a kettlebell squat or a baby learning to stand up, squatting is just balance. It's all about balance. If you break it right down and go from a neurological perspective, it's about linear, it's about vertical linear acceleration balance more than anything else. A deadlift then is horizontal linear acceleration. So you can almost bring those down to a squat is the saccule component in the vestibular system, and a deadlift is the utricle. Right? And it sounds really fun because as soon as you use anatomical terms, people think you're way smarter than what you really are.
Yeah.
Just drop them into conversation with your training partners and you're like, go, wow, shit, dude. You're enlightened.
Yeah, about six people just screenshotted this their phone and they just quoted exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
Putting on their Instagram story right now.
Utricle work. I want that to be a hashtag. What are you doing today? Oh, it's not chest day. It's not bench day. It's utricle day.
Utricle day.
Well, actually, Wilksy, he said one of the big things he learnt from this quote that he really admired was how much slapping somebody around the head helped them with their squat, I think it was. Which kind of makes sense if you think about it. You can kind of just displace those saccules and then they're off and running.
You know? Yeah, there you go.
Knock them back into alignment. Yeah, go on.
So, yeah, so I'm just sort of getting back. I'm trying to regain my train of thought there. With the bench press then, if a squat and deadlift is just about balance, and so anything you do that improves balance should improve your squat. And you just make it around that, and it really simplifies the process rather than these overly technical cues, having 20 cues per lift, which most people can't remember or execute properly. And it makes it really kind of complicated to do a fairly simple movement if we're constantly trying to refine those models down to what is the bare minimum I can give someone to get better. Then we go, a squat is vertical balance, a deadlift is horizontal balance, and a bench press is about shoulder stability. And so then literally anything you do to improve shoulder stability up until a certain point should improve your bench press.
I joke with my lifters all the time, Nathan, that I like to get overly complicated when I explain the squat sometimes, and then all of a sudden I'll be like, you know what, just bend your knees and straighten them. And it's really that simple.
Yeah.
I was out at the gym over the other side of town on Saturday helping a mate out. And what were we doing? Oh, he's an ex-strongman champion, and he's trying to build up to a 1,000-pound squat. And he'll do it because he's a freak. Obviously, not PA-approved freak, but he's a freak nonetheless. And we're trying to work him through lunges. And watching a 180-kilo guy try to do a lunge after not lunging for over 10 years is quite comical.
Yeah, I bet.
And now if you understand brain regions and where your topographic map of the body is, where it is in the brain and what areas of the body lie next to each other in that somatosensory cortex, you start to realize that right next to your feet is your knees and hips, and then right next to that in the topography of the brain is your genitals. Right? You can take the magic, you can make something out of this. So the cue that we came up for him that instantly improved the way he moved was, imagine there's a nice bowl of warm water directly underneath you. Now try and dip your nuts in the nice bowl of warm water. Everybody around almost choked and they dropped bars and that's ridiculous. What are you doing? Instantly, he got 200 times better at lunging.
Yeah, that's very funny. It's weird to think about, right? Isn't it? Yeah.
It is, isn't it? Just because the way our brains are really weird, the way they're set up and the way they wire together. But if you understand what goes where and what's next to what, it becomes really simple and you can start playing around with funny stuff like that. Which also goes back to, I think you guys had a question about cues and what cues work best. And they're always, the cue is always whatever is most personal and whatever your brain reacts strongest to. So a lot of the research out there and a lot of stuff is our brain pays attention to novel stimulus more than anything else because it's part of this, how we're wired for survival and to look out for dangerous things. So we want to look out for new things. So it looks for novelty, and it also looks for humour. The funniest things always are dick and fart jokes and things that are rude. Our brain pays attention to them. So if you can come up with a cue that revolves around something like that, your lift will grasp it much, much quicker.
Well, Alex...
I've got to shout out one of my lifters. Shout out to Matty Cherry. So when I always say hips forward to lock out the deadlift, he always changes to more dick.
Yeah, give him the extra inch.
Yeah, fill him up.
Just be a little bit bigger.
And it's funny.
I know that one.
There was
a bunch of guys in New Zealand on that one. They would talk about humping the bar in training, right? But that's not something you can yell out in a competition.
Yeah.
So you don't want your 12 training partners on your final deadlift all yelling, hump the bar, hump the bar. So they came up with midnight. So essentially do that thing that you would do with your girlfriend at midnight.
Very good.
So if someone was close to lockout, you'd hear someone yell out midnight and they would pull their hips through, you know, basically a little posterior pelvic tilt and a tuck, and the hips came through nicely.
Very good.
But everybody knew exactly what midnight meant.
Make love to that bar.
So what actually sort of shaped this thinking for you over the years? Is that just something that came from experience or from talking with others or what?
A lot of both. So I think one of the advantages to me training by myself, and now you gotta realize that people that choose to live in the Pilbara region of Western Australia, there's a number of things going on. Number one, Western Australians don't like the rest of the country. We call ourselves Western Australians before we call ourselves Australians. People from the Pilbara, and so there's a lot of secessionists in WA that go, we don't need the rest of the country. We've got all the money. The rest of you can get stuffed.
Yeah.
Now, if you move to the Pilbara region where all the mining and exports come out of, most people in the Pilbara are quite secessionist towards the rest of the state. So it's full with people that think we know better than everyone else, that we don't mix well with others, and we should live in really remote parts where we're isolated from the rest of the population. So it breeds a certain kind of thinking, and it's almost like a kind of a frontier mentality where we're willing to experiment more, we're willing to back ourselves a bit more, and by not being around other lifters that are telling us where we're wrong and right, I experimented way more than most lifters would or were willing to do. Fortunately, when I came into the sport, one of the first people I met was Stephen Pritchard. We developed a really good friendship. He's also a very alternative thinker, very research-based, and willing to try new things. So we used to swap a lot of ideas and try to push the sport forward that way. We also, there was a couple of websites we had up and going where we would try and give away as much training advice for free as we could, because most of the information about training up until that point was built around the old club system, where nobody told any other club how to train. Like, all your ideas were secret, and you'd never, you know, a Melbourne uni guy would never tell anyone else or a UQ lifter what they were doing or how they were training. We decided that we'd just tell everybody everything. And then if you could match what we're doing, then maybe you could beat us. But we just backed ourselves to be better.
Did you ever bluff them and tell them the wrong things?
Only once. So Tim Germanchus is a bloody funny guy in more ways than one. And he used to handle for me a lot at meets. I remember doing the 2012 Oceanias in North Sydney. And I was preparing, I think we're doing the raw bench comp. And so I had the soft suit on, and he goes, you could start. He goes, watch all these people. They're watching what you do, and they're all trying to copy you. And so I just started doing weird things. So I did this thing for a while where I'd put one strap up on my soft suit and the other strap I'd leave down while I was warming up. And there was at least two or three other people in the warm-up room that did exactly the same thing.
It's that funny thing, though, isn't it, where, like, people are just driven to emulate the people around them. It's like, you know, if you stand in the street and look up, like, people will join you.
Each one starts,
you know, and if you go to the beach, like, this is something I've noticed. I find it so funny. If you go surfing, there'll be four or five identical peaks that someone can surf at. And if there's two people out at one of them, then the next person who turns up almost invariably paddles out right next to them. You know?
Yeah.
It's like you've got to do what the other people do. There's very few people who'll just go out and do their own thing.
Yeah, we like that that reinforcement, don't we? That we're somehow on the right track.
So
yeah, go on.
I was going to ask, you know, having done all that thinking and talking with Stephen, and to people who don't know Stephen Pritchard who are listening to the podcast, he's also, I think he took your total record eventually, didn't he? He's one of the better powerlifters Australia's ever had.
Yeah, I'd say he'd be definitely amongst the top 10 best powerlifters all time. And he did it across multiple weight classes. So when I met him, he was a 110 kilo. He won nationals at 110, competed at Worlds in 2007 over in Austria at 110. He competed at under 125, he competed at over 125, and then he competed at over 120, won raw and single ply events. He was a really well-rounded lifter, fantastic, and a fantastic guy.
So what did your discussions and experience together sort of come to as far as an actual sort of training system goes? Like, what are the fundamental tenets of how you think people should train?
Oh, yeah. So we both started off doing a lot of West Side stuff, simply because that was the only available information on the internet. And then a lot of Metal Militia stuff. So we would cold call email people. So I remember sending emails to guys like Vinny DiZenzo, Sebastian Burns, Bill Crawford. Bill Crawford and Sebastian Burns were the Metal Militia, great bench pressers.
Vinny DiCenzo, so, also an amazing bench presser.
Oh, fantastic. You know, and really nice guys. And so because powerlifting was so small, if anybody asked you a question about what you did, you were just so excited that somebody cared enough to send you an email that these guys would tell us everything that they did. So there was a lot of just swapping of information. And I've still never met any of these guys, and I'd love to meet them someday. And we just started going round and round and took a very scientific approach to what we're doing and going, okay, our hypothesis is this, that if I do this, this should happen. So we'd run a four-week cycle or a three-week cycle. If we got better, we'd go, okay, it's probably this thing here that's working. Let's repeat that and pull out other things and see if it still works. So we're just constantly trying to isolate variables as to what was actually working. Both of us benefited a lot from the injuries that we had, which is kind of ironic. Stephen ruptured his bicep in 2008, and that's what kind of pushed him towards a more Russian-based training system. He started doing a lot of we'd get onto the Moscow Powerlifting Club website and translate their programs from Cyrillic into English. We're doing so much translation at one stage that I thought I could speak Russian. So some of the translations were pretty funny through Google Translate. You'd get like spin of rod on goat, right? And I think that was like we worked out by context that was a lunge or a incline press or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds pretty intuitive once you put it like that.
Thrusting in prone was bench press. So we just started doing that, and so then my injuries caught up to me around 2010, and I couldn't walk, let alone squat or deadlift. So I started. That's when I really went bench only. So I started with the Shaco bench only template that we had translated. We'd got 16 weeks worth of templates, and then every 4 weeks I would just change something within the template. So mostly for me, it was what could I take out and still go forward. I spoke with Freddie Smulter about this like 5 years after I started doing it. Turned out he'd done the same thing. And what we'd come up with, neither of our programs at that point looked anything like a Shaco program because we'd modified them so much to suit our own personal situation. And neither of our programs looked anything like each other's. But we had the same starting point. And so I think the biggest thing now is people get stuck on a program and are unwilling to just make small changes. I think that may have changed a lot because people kind of get this. There's so many online coaches out there now and good coaches. So they'll just jump coach to coach and they're never quite sure what was the change that I made that actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
And was just changing environments, was that enough to make it work?
I think that's a really interesting point. And it's really important with, like, Will and I have spoken about this a lot on the podcast, but the longer you stay with a coach, the better they get at catering to what you respond to.
And yeah, absolutely.
You start general, and then you get more and more individualized. And as you coach someone for a couple of years, the programs of those two lifters who started at the start might have looked the same at the start, but then they look completely different 2 years later.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so I approaching it very scientifically, and just trying to control variables whenever you can, I think is the key to good program design. And also getting really good at just seeing movement, like seeing lots and lots of squats and lots of benches and lots of good deadlifts. And the more you do that, the more you understand what's actually going on in each lift.
Mm.
Definitely.
I reckon we're due for a quick break, so we'll take one. We'll be right back for more chat with Nathan. Okay, guys, welcome back to Weekly Weights. We're here with Nathan Baxter, and during our break, we started talking about something that we wanted to get to later. So, Nathan, was it 2016 or 2017 that you had a severe stroke?
It was December 2016. I had six massive strokes all at once, and found out that we reversed back through there, and the stroke was actually caused by atrial fibrillation. And that atrial fibrillation had gone undiagnosed from about 2013 onwards. It's a genetic condition, mostly, and it's brought on by repeated high blood pressure. So trying to bench press 300 plus on a weekly basis probably drives your blood pressure up a fair bit, and brought on the fibrillation. Now, the first symptom that we didn't realize was a symptom at the time, but it got me going to different doctors and specialists from December 13 to December 16, was in Auckland, I think it was, for Oceania Championships. I did, and Wilkes and David Chain were there. They were helping me out. I did 310 for a double in the warm-up for benching, and they were fast. It was just to the chest, pop, pop. And literally everyone else in the warm-up room, it was kind of one of those moments where they're going, why are we here? Let's just walk away. So I was going to open on 320, I was going to go 320, 340, 360. That was the plan. Or maybe 365 to get that 800. I opened on 320, came to my chest, one arm locked out, one arm didn't move. And it was literally 10 minutes from when I did 310 for a double to my opener. And we couldn't work out what was going on. I ended up bombing. It happened all three times. That same thing happened a number of times over the next few years. When we go back through photos and what was going on, turns out they were big bouts of atrial fibrillation. So it's why my left arm didn't work, and it's why I had nagging left arm pain for so long. If you continue to train hard with atrial fibrillation, you'll just wear your heart down. So I wore my heart down to a 10% ejection fraction. That means when blood goes into the heart and your heart squeezes, in a healthy person, about two-thirds of that blood will come out of the heart and around the body. I was only getting 10% of that blood to come back out, and that was over the course of training for 3 years. And now you think, in that time, I was taking attempts at 350. I benched 340 up in Sweden. I locked out 352.5 in Sweden in 2015. I was just wearing myself down. So eventually my heart wore down to the point where I was in heart failure for probably a year and a half. And so I was trying to cut weight during that period, but my body weight wasn't going down. I was just getting puffier and puffier. So I saw a lot of doctors, and a lot of the doctors told me just stuff that was rubbish. They had diagnosis of musculoskeletal stuff, anxiety, depression. You're a fat bastard. Do some running. Your cardio sucks. You know, the whole gamut. And then eventually, like 3 days before I had a stroke, I got a diagnosis that I had severe panic disorder, which was just bullshit. I was panicked about dying. and I had slept. And so I ended up having six strokes because blood was literally sitting in my heart for so long that it clotted inside my heart. And then those clots came out, hit a bunch of spaces in my brain, and landed myself in hospital in intensive care for 8 nights.
And so I find it very interesting because you actually, you studied neuroscience. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I'm studying now.
Yeah, and so I'm wondering, was it the stroke itself that prompted you to study neuroscience, or was that something you were already interested in?
I was already deeply interested in it, but given my very limited capacity now for anything physical or anything stressful, I thought the least stressful thing that I could think of was going back to uni as a 40-year-old, which is incredibly stupid. That's really stressful. So I often wonder, I don't know what I'm doing there, hanging around with 20-year-olds all day.
Are you that student at university, the mature age student that always asks questions?
Oh, I hate that guy. I'm the guy that stares at that guy and gets him to be quiet. No, I really like the mature age student that somehow relates everything the lecturer is saying to their life experience.
Oh yeah, and their kids.
And their children, yeah.
We'll interject with, oh, that reminds me of a time that my eldest child did X, Y, or Z, and go, oh, dude, shut up.
Yeah. Fuck off.
I go, now the lecturer is going to have to speed over the next little part of the lecture and I'm going to miss something. I think I get really mad when people interject.
I think it's important to notice, to mention that you are skipping a lecture right now to do this podcast.
Yeah, that's correct.
For the boys.
Yeah, the boys.
I'll do it for the weights.
Oh, man. All right. So you had this stroke. Before we get onto powerlifting, what's that meant for you health-wise now? So you said you're not capable of doing anything particularly stressful. What's it meant for life?
So there's been various stages of my recovery. Like initially it was just trying to get the clots out of my system. I got sent home from hospital with a 1 centimeter blood clot still in my left ventricle. And I said, will I be fine with that there? And they said, no, not really. Just don't do anything that could get you excited. So I go, what does that include? And they go, things that are exciting. So
you're just living in like a state of ennui for as long as possible. Nothing really matters.
I just tried to be the cruisiest guy for the first 3 months and then I got this little electric zap to get my heart back in time. And so my heart's been back in rhythm for a year and a half now. And then it's been about regaining heart function and getting my ejection fraction back up to near normal, which I've got it back to 51% now, which is the bottom end of normal.
Yeah.
So all of my training is just cardiac rehab. Initially, there was a lot of things like I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to speak properly again. I'm still getting around, still learning how my brain works now because I don't learn the way I used to learn. My brain does weird things sometimes. Like I've had a few bouts where I just have massive blackout memory loss, which is not dissimilar to the blackout memory loss that I had as a 19-year-old and would drink too much. Now I have memory loss that's not related to going out and drinking shitloads. It's just, I just miss an afternoon. So really it's trying to piece my brain back together and trying to understand how I can function at a high level with a brain that's essentially scarred and a little bit broken.
So you've said most of your training or all of your training is now cardiac rehab. What does that mean for your involvement in powerlifting the sport?
At first I had all these ambitions of coming back and doing one last competition so I could go out under my own steam because I wasn't happy that my last comp was the Arnold Classic in the USA, the bench comp, where I bombed. Like I had 3 attempts at 350 and locked out on the right side and couldn't lock out my left arm. So I didn't really want that to be my last hit out. I thought, I could come back and just do one last comp. And it was really about lifting one more time with the boys because that's what I cared about lifting most, was just doing stuff with guys that I cared about, just doing stuff with my mates. But then I realized that if I put too much pressure on my brain, so lift anything heavy, which includes Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I used to love that as well. I really enjoyed letting my friends punch me in the face and choke me. I think that's a really great way to get to know someone.
And outside the bedroom as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, midnight.
So really now I can't get a clearance to do that. So I have to resort to choking strangers on the bus. It's I'll take what I can get. So it's just, you know, there's severe complications for me to do heavy stuff that may raise my blood pressure, so I don't really go there. I've had to develop a love affair with the Concept 2 rower. Dear. Which is...
That's grim. Man.
Yeah, it's not fun. And to do that on a arthritic hip that needs replacing sometimes can get a little bit painful. Mm. So I do that. And, you know, it's working. It's got me back to where I am now that I can lead a relatively normal life. I'd like to do a whole lot more where I can get rid of the constant tiredness and hopefully one day completely come off all the medication that I'm on. And have a regular life where I'm not 170 kilos and I'm not trying to bench press 400 kilos or anything like that. And I'm not putting stupid amount of weight on my back.
So when you
so as far as powerlifting involvement now, it really isn't official. Now I'm the old guy that used to lift, or according to one guy. Hopefully Damien Horn listens to this because I got this at the 2016 Juniors and Masters. Someone came up and asked me after I'd refereed their session if I'd ever thought of competing one day. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah, maybe. I'll think about it. It looks like fun. So, yeah, now I'm just the old guy that may or may not have lifted one day.
And so when you look back at your powerlifting career, is it really just time with the boys to you, or was there something more to powerlifting, to you?
It ended up being about the powerlifting family and the worldwide powerlifting family, which, like, we'll move it on to a little bit of politics, which is the bit that I'm deeply saddened by the split with the IPF and the way the IPF handled this situation. Because for me, when I knew that I was having a stroke, the first person I called, because it was like 3 a.m, the very first person I called was Jonah Leo, who's the 3-time world bench press champion from South Dakota. I had one of possibly my closest friend in the sport. We've traveled a lot together. We'd spend a number of weeks together each year traveling and trying to bench press and then drinking a lot of beer.
It's a good friendship.
And for an organization to basically divide people along those lines based on what was best for administrators and what was best for administrators' egos is not the powerlifting that I fell in love with. The powerlifting that I came into was a bunch of people that would have your back, that would train with you, that literally didn't give a shit what you did. They cared that you bought the first round of the bar. They cared how much you lift. They cared that you put your weights away, that you helped out in the warm-up room. For the longest time, I had no idea how smart Gordon Thorogood was. Like, the guy's like a genius nuclear professor and goes to the Small Hadron Collider and people ask him to speak. I had no idea. I just thought he was the cool referee that sometimes had a beer with me. And that's what I loved about powerlifting. Like, literally no one cared what you lifted. Like, it's meant to be the sport about lifting weights, but really it's a sport about drinking beer and coming up with weird stories after a competition. Most of the people that contacted me in hospital was a steady stream of powerlifters from around the world. And so for the IPF to decide that, no, we're going to break up those relationships just because we don't like what an administrator did and not look for a solution that benefits all members, I think is just absurd. And it really put me off a lot.
And do you think Robert, by starting a new federation, has served the best interests of the sport? I'm curious. This is somebody who is his friend as well.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the best interest of the sport. But I don't know what is in the best interest of the sport anymore. Like, the fact, you know, I saw something the other day, somebody asking, how can I put this? The guy that I feel worse for right now is Jezza Uapa. Because whatever Jezza does now in world powerlifting is going to be a world powerlifting record. But if he's not beating Ray Williams, who cares?
Yeah, that's
true. He's not getting the chance to go head to head with Ray once or twice a year. And Ray's also suffering because he's not going head-to-head with the guy that will push him the most.
Mm.
I feel sorry for Liz Craven is now no longer allowed to go head-to-head with Marissa Rinder.
Mm.
It's absurd. It's just silly. And so we're going to have to do these theoretical comparisons like they have in boxing. Now they have five major world federations and this constant debate, who's really the best? So maybe if we can, you know, every time we splinter, I think we lose a little bit of the fabric of what powerlifting should be. And maybe if we splinter far enough, then everything will come back to whole. I don't know, some kind of Donnie Darko metaphysical wormholes and time travel kind of way.
What I find interesting is that, and this is something that your lived experience would have to support, is that in spite of all these splits at the administrative level, there's a huge degree of still unity within the powerlifting community, at least for the most part, in the participants. Because, you know, people like Vinny DiCenzo and stuff who are helping you, you know, they're busy lifting in multiply federations in the US. They're not IPF lifters. You know, but because you are a powerlifter, you know, those people feel that you share something.
Yeah, I met a fairly high-profile internet guru type person a number of years back when I used to go to Arizona for work a lot.
Mm.
And we got introduced through a mutual friend, and he said, oh, okay, yeah, come around and train with me and my buddy. His buddy was an even higher-profile internet writer for T-Nation. And the conversation we had was literally like the one that you have when you're kids. And he goes, oh, so you like powerlifting? I said, yeah, I love powerlifting. He goes, yeah, I like powerlifting too. We should hang out.
Yeah, let's be friends.
And then the next conversation, so do you like Mexican food? He goes, I love Mexican food. We should be friends. Do you like powerlifting, Mexican food, and then drinking beer? I go, I love all those things.
It's like stepbrothers.
Let's be best friends. Right? It's stepbrothers.
It's like stepbrothers.
You're making it sound like powerlifters have all like skipped a developmental stage. We're those simple kids that run around and are just like thrilled by our sameness.
Simple folk.
It's like that those 4-year-olds out the front riding their bikes and go, you like riding bikes and red cordial? I love those things. Yeah. Let's be friends. But really that's the only thing I had in common with most of the people I met in powerlifting. A few of them, probably the guys that I've become closer with, like we're a similar age, we have similar political and religious convictions, we have families or kids around the same age.
Yeah.
But, like, I'll pull Liz Craven out because she's probably one of the most opposite people to me. Like, we're a similar age, but she's
angry.
Yeah, people think we're angry, and we like people thinking that, so we'll carry it on.
And another thing you have in common is you've both been on this podcast.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, you had her on first. I'm not sure about that. So she built the following and I come in to ruin your following. But literally all we had in common was that we like lifting weights and we have a great love of beer. And everything else is kind of secondary and we can work around that. And that's it, you know. And me and Liz have fought a couple of times and we've dealt with that. And, you know, the last time we hung out was over at the 2017 at the Arnold, where we got massively drunk in a bar across from the convention center with a bunch of powerlifters, all of whom the only thing we shared was a love of beer and powerlifting. I think, you know, when we look for those commonalities like that, powerlifting's really fun. When we look to go, oh, but you're a raw guy and I'm a single ply and that guy's a double ply and he's in this federation, I'm in this federation, you can always find something that's going to be different. We can seek to divide like that. But as long as people like powerlifting and consuming any kind of food or beverage, I think we've got common ground to work on.
So we spoke to Liz about her party background. Can you out-party Liz?
Well, yeah, I'm 170 kilos. Yeah, it's pretty easy. Like, by the time I'm falling on the floor, I'm barely getting warmed up. and you'll find, like, you find with travel that the funnest bunch of people, and I'm not just saying this because they're my guys, but the funnest bunch of people to be around are super heavyweights because we give less shits. We just don't care. And then the people that are most fun amongst super heavyweights are super heavyweight benchers because we're the most marginalized people in the sport. They go, you're fat guys that lay on your back the whole time. What are you good for? And we go, oh, we're
how much more lazy can you be?
Yeah.
Like, oh, so you're strong? Yeah, only when I'm lying down.
I mean, you're technically an elite athlete, so, you know, all those gym junkies who are giving you shit with their six packs, they're chumps.
We got called a bunch of, that we were nothing but a bunch of home run hitters at the Arnold's 1 year. And we were constantly getting smashed at the Arnold because, like, there's a lot of red on the board at a single ply bench only meet because we're all going for the fence.
Mm.
You only need one good lift to win. So, yeah, and
Barry Bonds, baby.
Yeah. And so they go, oh, you've nothing but a bunch of home run hitters. And I'm going, you know, people like home runs. There's a home run derby each year. There's not a base hit derby.
Put asses in the seats.
Yeah.
You know, we bring people in. And so we, you know, I think our attitude is a little bit different. We're a little bit looser, both in terms of what we do on the platform and then what we do after. So, Liz came out with a bunch of bench presses and she had a great time. She made it back to Australia somehow. I think we put her in the right Uber at the end of the night, but yeah, it was good times. I tend not to, I'm not meant to party so hard now, but you know, it's still there.
Can't help but reminisce, no. Look, I'd like to bring this to training just a little bit, because you are known as a bench press guy, and I know JP, this is your weekly shout out. He gets a weekly shout out. I know that JP at one stage spoke to you about his bench press. What do you consider to be the most important things universally for bench press programming?
Speed and volume. It is that simple. Like, it's just speed and volume. If you look around, like the typical Australian lifter is someone with a decent squat, a great deadlift, and a shitty bench.
Yeah, you're looking at two.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So literally, if you describe JP, you describe almost every Australian powerlifter. Good squat, no bench, great deadlift.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's a cultural standard. We've come to accept that Australians have bad benches, and we go, oh, that's normal. And we start and we train like everyone else who has a shitty bench, and no one trains like the person with the good bench or understands why a good bench presser is getting a lot out of that lift. There's what works for squatting and deadlifting doesn't work for bench pressing, simply because bench pressing is a flexion based movement. It is rapid upper body flexion. So one of the things that I was most interested in and was developing a lot is you look at the best bench pressers in the world, most of them aren't powerlifters. The best bench pressers in the world are shot putters or javelin throwers. If Kim Mickle, who was the best javelin thrower in Australia for women for a number of years, I remember she came to my garage one time and she warmed up with a set of 90 kilos for 10 reps, like it was nothing, just in street clothes. Massive, massive bench on her.
That's Will's 1RM.
Yeah, it's close to.
And the reason she's so good at it is throwing is just rapid upper arm flexion, right? If you look at the areas of the brain responsible for flexion patterns versus extension patterns, one's in the pons, one's in the medulla, they're both primarily brainstem movements. Extension does really well for grinding. And if you look at in a very mechanical kind of setting, extension-based movements will benefit from grinding. A flexion-based movement won't benefit from a grind. It benefits from being more ballistic and faster. So in terms of setting up a program, you want to bench as often as you can, as fast as you can, for as long as you can. So whether that's 1, 2, 3, 5 reps for 5 sets or 1 set or however long, it takes time to develop. So if you can make a weight move really fast and then you go above that weight and it starts to slow down, go back to the weight that moves fast. Do it for as many reps until that slows down. So it might be 2 reps or it might be 3 reps or it might be 5. Do that for as many sets until that first set starts to drop off in speed. If you want to get really technical with this kind of stuff, the mad professor, Dan Baker, who used to be the head strength coach for the Brisbane Broncos, he's got a product. It's like an armband, an accelerometer type thing. It's really cool. I can't remember what it's called though, but it's a great device.
Yeah.
And he's really good with this stuff. If you just keep on training, once you see a speed drop off, you're done for the day. If you can come back the next day and make it move just as quick, that's your training frequency. Do that. If it takes you 2 days to come back to do it just as quick, that's your training frequency. So over time, you'll see the best guys in the world tend to train 5 or 6 times a week for their bench. The majority do. There's always a couple of outliers. You look at like Jennifer Thompson is an outlier amongst outliers. I saw somebody did a statistical regression on her, and she's like, it's like 5 standard deviations away from the next best person.
Fuck me.
Yeah.
And you go, it's almost like, and like I'm great friends with the Thompsons and I love them dearly, but it's almost to the point where I wouldn't bother doing anything that Jennifer does because I'm just not like her. But if you come back to the majority of really good bench pressers do speed and volume. I met Bill Cashmere a number of years ago, and he was telling me stories about the way they trained in the 70s and 80s, and it was the same deal. It was a lot of bodybuilding type stuff, but you want a bigger muscle that can move a weight fast, and that was it. And these guys were benching 300 back in the 80s by doing it this way. But if you start to treat a bench press like a deadlift, you'll have a great deadlift but a really bad bench press.
So you said something when we were preparing for this episode, which was that the biggest mistake that a lot of lifters make in approaching the bench press is a mental one. So did you mean that in terms of the way we actually go about training the lift, or do you mean that in terms of execution and approaching the bar?
A bit of both. I think it became really cool a few years ago to talk about how bad you are at benching, especially here in Australia. I think if you're constantly talking about how bad you are at something, you'll tend to do things that reinforce that story. So mentally, I think going out there thinking that you're going to have a bad bench press, you'll probably have a bad bench press. It seems to be the best athletes in the world have this almost arrogant self-belief in what they can do. Guys used to ask me if I thought that I could beat Freddie Smalter, and I've gone, yeah, I think so. I was totally wrong. I couldn't. I didn't even get close. But I always believed I could. Mm. So you have to have that slight touch of arrogance to think you can actually do it. Otherwise, there's no way I'd be unracking 340 kilos and holding it over my face. So there's that, and then just understanding mentally that it's a speed movement, not a grind movement, will change your approach to getting it done. Most Australian lifters, as a rule, lower the bar too slowly. They don't have enough control around their scapula, and they have the bar in the wrong spot the whole time. So if the one technical thing I'll give out, to get better at benching immediately, stop putting the bar in the middle of your hand. Put it on the heel of your palm.
Yeah, Alex and I are both looking at our hands right now. So when the bar sits in the heel of your palm, how do you orient your wrist? Is your arm internally rotated or externally rotated?
It doesn't matter.
So why the heel of your palm?
If you look at... So the force, if you put it on the heel of your palm... we're not taping this, are we?
This is audio.
I'll explain it to you guys, and I'll show you over the video here.
Yeah.
So the force goes straight up through the bones of your forearm into the heel of your palm, and it's a straight line.
Yes.
If you put the bar in the middle of your hand, it goes up through the wrist joint and takes a left-hand turn to get to where the bar is sitting in the middle of your hand. So if you're holding it like you're doing a chin-up or a deadlift or something, the force is literally going around the corner before it gets to the bar and then pushing up through the bar.
So it's like it's creating an extra lever in that kinetic chain, but it's not one that you're using to exert force. It's just sitting out there.
It's just leaking force.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to I used to be big into kettlebells, and one of the stands we talk about in kettlebell lifting is stacking the joints.
Yeah.
It's just lining joint up over joint. And if you're not lining the bar up over joints, then you're going to have a force leakage. Also, it's not a press, it's a throw. Philosophically, that was the biggest change. Once I realized I'm not trying to press the bar. I'm trying to throw the bar as fast as I can. Then benching became a little bit better.
What about lower body movement in the bench press? What are your thoughts behind that?
I'll give a shout out. I was out with Ben Wright last night, who's a great Paralympic bench presser. That dude does really, really well without legs. In fact, the best bench presser in the world doesn't have legs. He straps himself to the bench. It's my belief that it's not leg drive isn't what we think it is. Leg drive is a means of stabilizing the pelvis. So if you watch when people lift their butt off the bench, like what Megan Hinchley does all the time on Instagram.
Shout out,
Megan.
Yeah.
She definitely listens.
It's quite impressive that she can get those glutes up off a bench, though.
They are big.
You just need to train more glutes, and then that won't be an issue.
Yeah.
But if you watch someone's hips come off the bench, the point at which the force starts to accelerate is the point at which their pelvis stabilizes. When it's unstable, the bar doesn't move. When it's stable, bar goes like a rocket. So one of the biggest areas of force leakage from your feet up to your shoulders will always be your pelvis.
So you're sort of cueing leg stability versus any movement in the lower body, like no leg drive. It's more just like tension and stability.
Yeah, like I didn't realize for a long time people didn't get sore where I got sore in a bench press. I was always complaining about how sore my lower back was after benching, because I was arching so hard to get my pelvis into a really tightly locked anterior pelvic tilt. Who was this one? Scott Yard was his name. He was another multiply bencher, really big bench on him. And his cue was balls to bench.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I get that.
Roll your pelvis forward. So locking the pelvis in place. To do that, you have to have tremendous lower back strength, and it really fries your lower back benching well.
Is that why you could never deadlift very well?
Have you seen the size of my belly? I can't get down to the bar, man. I was always very good at squatting and benching, and then deadlifting was always a struggle, just anatomically.
Weird
lengths for deadlifting. But my best deadlift was 307.5 when I did the total record, and that was raw.
That's good.
Yeah. So I did that raw in a three lift after benching a lot in a shirt. But it's a really ready-made excuse saying, oh, no, my lower back hurts, I can't deadlift.
What has equipped benching taught you about raw benching and vice versa?
Oh, precision. The biggest thing about equipped benching is learning to be very precise in every movement, which will always carry over into your raw technique. Raw training for shirt is... Well, that was the bulk of training anyway. Is like, you know, I put the shirt on once a week for 6 weeks at a time, and the rest of the year was always raw training. But it was about learning how to move the bar quickly, but with really minute control, like being able to touch my T-shirt without touching my chest, and be able to reverse it rapidly without a shirt on. So then when I put a shirt on, you really maximize what the shirt is there for to do. But if you think about in a shirt, you've got super maximal weights, and you've got a very fine line to bring the bar down and up in. And if you get out of line, things go wrong quickly.
Mm. Yes.
You know, you can sit up the back of a raw meet, and you can go, in about 5 seconds, that bench is going sideways. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Oh, there it goes. And the spotters are there to get it. A bench going wrong in a shirt just goes like a zap. It's like, oh, what happened? And the bar's flying back towards their face or flying towards their belly, or you have what happened to me in 2010 when Wilkes gave me the longest pause in the history of the sport and I passed out.
Shout out, Robert.
Yeah, Robert.
Yeah, that was so I passed out at this comp in a shirt because Robert held me on the chest for what seemed like a minute and a half.
I will say, though, you've refereed me before and you have the most generous press calls ever. And I really appreciated it.
See, some people really don't like my press calls. They go, you held me way too long. I go, well, if you can keep that bar stationary, if you hit your chest and that bar's still, I'm going to call press straight away because that's what the rule says.
Yeah, that's how I approach it too.
If there's any motion in the bar, I'm going to wait.
Physics says that the bar has to be stationary for it to reverse direction at some stage. So see, all benches could be touch and go.
I would be down with that. Hey, he paused in there somewhere. I'm kind of like, if you're good, you'll get a fast press call. If you're not good at benching, you're going to get a really slow call.
Yeah, and then you'll be worse at benching again.
Yeah. So I tried to referee here in Australia like I think about some of the really good referees I've had internationally. Guys like Johnny Graham or Bob Keller is pretty good. There's a Hungarian guy that's great. Honey Smith from South Africa was always
Honey's good.
And guys that were just real, like you knew what they were going to do, and they were the same every time. I don't really care if someone's got a slow press command, as long as that slow press command is consistent.
Yeah.
It's like, go for it.
Yeah. Shout out Bree Wyatt for slow press commands. Well, red lights, red hair, Bree. She's bloody slow press call.
She'll definitely fucking be annoyed about this.
Oh, yeah.
Angry gnome.
If you got red hair and therefore no soul, you have to make up for it in life somehow.
Oh, you're going to expect an angry email from Bree. we're going to take another break, and then we'll come back and hit Nathan with our four questions that tell us everything we need to know about a person. Thank you.
Awesome.
Weekly Weights. Welcome back to the show. We're going to hit Nathan with our four questions that tell us everything you need to know about a person. First one is, if you could go out to dinner with one person dead or alive, who would it be?
I like questions like that. Like, depending on the mood, like, you get these really nice ones. Like, dead or alive, now, to be honest, like, I'm feeling a little bit reflective now. I'd want to go out to dinner with my dad. He passed away a number of years ago, and I'd want to ask him a whole bunch of questions about parenting, about what it's like to parent teenagers.
That's easily the sweetest response we've gotten so far. Everybody else has been some type of celebrity or something. Easily the most introspective.
See, if I went out to dinner with my dad would be going out with a celebrity, so it'd be cool for him.
Now that you've been on Weekly Weights, your profiles.
I want to get on Instagram straight away to just see the followers come flooding in.
I think you've bench pressed more in kilos than we've had total listens, to be honest.
Oh, that's awesome.
All right, question two is, who is your favorite athlete of all time? This could be powerlifting or any sport.
Oh, favorite athlete of all time. Getting a little bit more. I'm trying to think of his name now. Favorite athlete of all time. I grew up around rugby, so I'm probably trying to think of a rugby player. Ray Price. Help
you. Ray Price, Ray did you say?
Ray Price. He was a dual international. Played for the Parramatta Eels in rugby league and played for Australia in league and union. And they used to call him Mr. Perpetual Motion. And what I like about him and what kind of what I take from him now is just this idea of never stopping, just never getting knocked down, you know, like kind of Chumbawamba style. I get knocked down, I get back up again. But Ray Price was amazing that this is a guy that even at the end of his career, I think his last game was 1984 Grand Final, which he won, and him and Mick Cronin retired together, and he was still the best guy in the last 10 minutes of a game. And so for me, that's what I want to be for both in sport and life. I want to be the best guy in the last 10 minutes. Like, it's really cool to be good early and peak when you're in juniors or whatever, but I really want to be good at the end.
But you were never a good deadlifter?
Yeah, very disappointing. Horribly disappointing.
All right. The questions three and four are the fun, good ones, in my opinion, because I ask them. Okay. Question three. Which movie or television character are you most like?
On what day? The most that I want to be like, I guess, is I want to be like Thor. I'm most like the Hulk. I've always wanted to be the, you know, the like Chris Hemsworth style, long blonde hair, big muscles, ripped, good looking. But really, I'm the big ugly green guy that is stronger when he's mad and is generally misunderstood. So these days, probably less Hulk and more Shrek.
Fantastic. All right, question four. So your life's being made into a montage. What music goes behind it?
I Walk the Line, Johnny Cash.
I Walk the Line. That's a good one.
Yeah. We haven't had Johnny Cash yet.
Yeah, we haven't had Johnny Cash. We've had a lot of Eye of the Tiger, which is...
You know, Eye of the Tiger. Yeah. No, really, no one's Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, tell that to Jules Nannetti. She thinks she's Eye of the Tiger.
I started, when I can't remember, we had walkout music maybe 2010 or 2009 Nationals, which were in North Sydney.
Like wrestling.
And everybody started going for the, because we had this wicked DJ there, and everybody gets like, you know, Highway to Hell or some Metallica or, you know, really hyped up music. And then, of course, all the Polynesian guys want this hardcore rap music.
Yeah.
And then I broke it all up with Johnny Cash. I Walk the Line. This ching 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 ching. And then I used to have that at the they used to play that for me at the Arnold teacher as well.
So one of my mates that I went to school with, he did the pilot season of this reality show where they train up complete chumps into like mixed martial arts athletes and then get them to fight each other. And it's called Wimp to Warrior. And I went and watched his fight that was going to be like the end of the season or whatever live, and he walked out to something, you know, really stereotypical, like Ambitions as a Rider by Tupac or something like that. I don't know what it was. But the guy...
Run This Town by Rihanna.
Yeah. the guy he went out to fight walked out to What Is Love. But, I mean, yeah, by Hathaway, the Don't Hurt Me thing.
What is love? Don't hurt me. Don't hurt me.
And so he's walking out like... giving the crowd a wave to Don't Hurt Me, and it was so funny. It was phenomenal, and it just took the wind out of my mate's sails so much. I remember seeing it and just pissing myself. It was like the most anti-hype moment before a fight, but I loved it.
See, I like that. BJ Penn in the second half of his career used to come out to that really cool Hawaiian music.
What, like ukulele stuff?
It wasn't ukulele stuff, but it was really stirring, but it wasn't like hardcore kind of bang thumping fight music that you would expect. It was a bit more mellow and a bit more, there's a lot of national Hawaiian pride there, I think, that was coming through in the music, and it was a bit more emotional driven and nicer than most UFC fight music.
Yeah, everybody wants that song. I think, I don't know if it's Jay-Z or somebody else, but the one that samples Kashmir by Led Zeppelin, you know, the hip-hop one where it's got like the really big drum beat and then it's got the doo-doo-dunk. The one they play in the NRL games. That's like what everybody wants to walk out to.
It's kind of like all the, you know, all these memes that put up that say, you know, I'm the alpha wolf or I'm a lion. I'm kind of, no, you're not. Everybody wants to think they are, but I think a lot of people are lions in that they're lazy. They sleep for 20 hours a day and women do most of the work.
Yeah.
So if you go on that as a lion, then I think, yeah, people are lions, but really nobody wants to go, yeah, I'm just an average guy that likes average music and will probably do a pretty average lift.
You've triggered me so much. I fucking hate animal memes. Like as in, I love animal Instagram pages, but lifting has nothing to do with animals. And putting lifting quotes in front of a picture of a lion is the dumbest fucking thing in the world. So I'm so glad someone's brought it up on the show.
Yeah, I think, like, if you put a picture of a brown bear and put a quote about a brown bear in lifting, I'd be down with that. Like, I sleep too much, I'm kind of fat, I'll do the bare minimum, but if you make me angry, I might rip your face off.
Bare necessities.
I'm like, yeah, let's go with that. Honey's really nice, but so is mauling people that piss you off.
All right. So on the off chance after that that somebody wants to work with you, are you actually coaching people for powerlifting now?
Oh, I do. I coach two people at all. One's Daniel Macri, who was Australian Amateur Strongman Champion. We're doing just a one-off project. I think he's one of the few Australians going around that has a genuine chance of squatting 1,000 pounds raw. So it would be raw with knee wraps, but I think he can do that. And hopefully over the next 12 months, you'll see him do that in some non-PA-affiliated competition.
Get him in Big Dogs?
And well, I don't think he's interested in Big Dogs. Like, he's at the end of his career now, and he just wants to knock off this one thing.
You'll have to coach him, like, wearing a trench coat and a fake moustache so that Rob doesn't get onto you if he does compete in Big Dogs.
I once sent Robert a picture of me and Ed Cohen at the Arnolds and just said, Ed says hi. And so in response to that, Robert did my entry for 2014 Bench Worlds in Denmark, and he listed my coach as E. Cohen. So
such a good troll, Robert.
He's a great troll. He gives as good as he gets. I like to give it to him. He gives it back. Probably over the years, he's probably a few up on me, like the time that I told him that I wasn't available to ref at Worlds, and he told them I was able to ref every single session.
All right, so if people did want to get a hold of you or they did want to follow you on social media, where's the best place to do it?
You go Twitter. The handle is Baxter Strength. On Instagram, it's Baxter Strength Systems, and Facebook, it's just my name, Nathan Baxter. And if there's enough mutuals, I'll add you. It comes with the warning that if you send me a friend request, you are telling me that I can comment on anything you've ever posted, and you're choosing not to be offended by me commenting on your pictures of cats.
I'm offended that you haven't, honestly, up until now for me, but I'll check my phone in 20 minutes and see what you've got.
I'll get onto that tonight.
All right. So final job for you, Nathan. It's Weekly Weights. All our guests sing a song. You're going to sing us out. So long as you say the words Weekly Weights, we'll accept anything.
All right. So I've got a little treat for you. I'm a big William Shatner fan, and I don't know if you've ever heard his semi-spoken word singing albums. One of my favorite, I said my montage music would be I Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. So I'm going to try and do my best William Shatner doing Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line.
All right.
All right, so you've been listening to Weekly Weights, episode 19, The Greatest Ever with Nathan Baxter, talking about not much. And this is how I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds because you're mine. I walk the line. I find it very... very easy to be true. I find myself alone each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
All right, that was Nathan Baxter. Thank you very much, mate. Guys, we'll chat to you next week. See ya.